Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. I'm Jeff Gamet. Today is Wednesday, June 17th, 2015. And with me today, I have John Martellaro. How are you, John?
Good morning. This is John Apple Watch Martellaro here in Denver.
That's awesome. Yeah. And actually, that's part of the reason why I wanted you here today. But before we jump into that, I just wanted to let everyone know that our sponsor this week is lynda.com, the amazing online video training company. And I'm excited to be talking about them, but you're going to have to wait a few minutes for that. First, what I wanted to do was let's get kind of retrospective here for a minute. So, John, I've had an Apple Watch a little bit longer than you. You've had an Apple Watch for about a month.
Yeah, I got it on May 14th.
And I thought that this is about time for us to look back at the Apple Watch experience. Because, you know, you start off with holy crap, this is the most amazing thing ever. And then a month later, you may feel different about the product. Now, I'm guessing because your middle name is now Apple Watch, that you are still loving yours.
I am still loving mine. What interested me during the time I was waiting for my watch and reading about the watch was my suspicion, it turned out to be correct, that Apple engineers had a good idea about the division of labor between the iPhone and the Apple Watch, and what little things that you needed. I think it was based on a lot of feedback and experience from watch users and engineers and executives who would say, well, you know, I missed a text message from one of the vice presidents because my phone was in my office and I was in a conference room talking or somebody, something like that. And that's exactly what's happened to me along the way. Last night I got a text message on my watch transferred from the phone. And I was up and about in another room and I needed to see that text message when it came in and I needed to know what time it came in. We don't always have our phone glued to our face. You know, we're not using Google Cardboard. We don't have it stuck, you know, in a lanyard around our neck. The phone can often be resting on a table. When you're out and about, you know, when you're out shopping or at a restaurant or something, your phone is maybe on the restaurant table. It's right there in your face. But in the office place, it tends to stay put. And so when you get a phone call, you have to go running. You hear it ringing in the other room. You pick it up. It's still ringing. You touch ID. You get logged on. You know, you have to then touch it again to answer the phone call. It takes some time. Several times now, I've been in another room and I've gotten an important phone call and my watch rang and I just touched it and there I was talking. Mm-hmm. And so it made me think that, you know, this is one of the pleasures of having an Apple Watch. It's an elegant division of the labor. The engineers thought deeply, not just from, you know, their own ideas, but based on good principles of human ergonomics about what a watch should do for you because it's always on your wrist. And I think that was largely overlooked as a design feature when people were belly aching about the watch's battery life or whether we really needed a watch after all because a phone could do everything that we needed to do. And turns out that's not true. I have, of course, enjoyed using Apple Pay on my watch. The clerks are always astounded and blown away. The other thing is that when I'm getting ready to go out for a walk or ready to head out, the simplest and fastest way for me to know how to dress, checking the outside temperature, is to tap my watch. It's always connected to my phone and it always knows what the outside temperature here is in our town. So I'm finding that the watch is helping me, just as I hoped it would, in all these little ways that are part of the design. And I can't think of anything that's left out yet, but I am noticing all the little things that is helping me when my phone is sitting somewhere. The other thing it's doing is that it's keeping track of my movements. up and down around the office. You know, when I'm not walking with my phone in my pocket, my phone sits on my desk and doesn't register any movement. But my watch is very good about telling me my standing hours during the day. It's keeping track of my steps around the office when the phone is sitting still. So it's doing all these good things for me that I'm really starting to enjoy and appreciate, besides being a beautiful timepiece. And I'm pretty much addicted to it. And I'm awfully appreciative of the division of labor and the little things it does for me.
You know, I wouldn't say that I'm addicted to my Apple Watch, but it has become a permanent part of my whole technology world. And it's definitely changed how I interact with my iPhone. I don't pay as close attention to where I set my iPhone down in my office now that I have an Apple Watch. And that's because there's so many things that otherwise I needed to grab my iPhone for all the time that I can now do for my Apple Watch. The interesting thing for me is that I found that I actually have to use the ping feature on the Apple Watch to find my iPhone a lot. And that's because I'm not paying attention to where I'm setting it down now.
Tell us about where you found your iPhone the other day.
All right. So the other day, I didn't know where my iPhone was, but I knew it was somewhere around me. So I hit the ping button on my Apple Watch, and I hear this really quiet ping sound. And I'm thinking, that's really weird, because usually it's loud. So I'm getting closer to where the sound is. Finally, I opened up my refrigerator door, and there's my iPhone sitting on the shelf.
Well, you got to keep those circuits cool.
Got to keep those circuits cool. And all those people that tell you if you put your phone in a refrigerator that it masks all the radio signals so that the government or the bad guys or whoever can't access your device. Wrong.
Well, Jeff, I suggest you wrap your refrigerator in tinfoil now.
I was thinking of pulling the whole thing apart and getting a bunch of brass mesh and just turning my fridge into a Faraday cage.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Yeah. So
then you'd never find it.
No, I'd never find it. Never again. So the interesting thing that I have noticed for both of us when we talk about the way we use our Apple Watch is that we really don't talk about the fitness features. And that's a big selling point for Apple. And I'm finding that the fitness features are nice, but they are not something that's making me retire my Fitbit. I tend to use the fitness features on the watch to get a reminder if I need to stand up, like if I've been sitting at my desk far too long. And when I go out for a walk or a hike or a run, I start a fitness count, cycle thing, whatever, on the watch, so that it's tracking how far I'm going and everything that goes along with the hike or the run. But other than that, I'm really not using it for much in the way of fitness. Although there is one thing that I would love to see, and I'm betting this will come once developers have access to the sensors. I want an app that is monitoring my heart rate so that if it goes too high, and I will set what that too high point is, that I get an alarm. And this stemmed from recently having a really serious allergic reaction to dairy. I had gone to a coffee shop and they made my drink with milk instead of soy.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and I was in a rush and I wasn't paying attention and I took off and I'm drinking this thing and I'm like, wow, this doesn't taste normal. And then I realized why and it was too late. But I didn't realize that I was having a severe reaction because at some point my cognitive skills kind of dip when I'm having a reaction like that. And my heart rate resting was at 104. And had I known, then I would have been far more likely to realize that I needed to get some medical help. And I didn't know. As it turns out, in the end, I got the medical help I needed, and I was fine. But I would have been able to address that sooner if I'd had that little alarm letting me know that my heart rate was way out of the normal range. So yeah. I think something like that will come. And at that point, the Apple Watch for me will become more of a critical health monitoring tool. And I think that's actually really neat.
I do have one complaint. I have several complaints, but one of the principal complaints is that my iPhone, and this is part of iCloud, and I think is slow to update my calendar entries, both from the iCloud to the phone. And it seems to be even slower, the iPhone, updating the calendar on my watch. So the other day I changed an appointment time, and I was looking at my watch, and I'm going, no, that can't be right, because I have the calendar on my utility face. And I just touch it, and I can see my calendar for the day. I think it's very helpful. But I noticed that the time was off, so I went back to my phone, and I went to the calendar page, and you know, I pull down and let it update. So then within a few seconds, my watch goes, doink, and then I see the calendar on the watch update. I might have missed an appointment if I hadn't been aware of the fact that I had changed the appointment time. So I'd like to see iCloud updating my phone faster because I made the change on the Mac. And I'd like to see the phone updating the watch a lot faster.
You know, I would like to see that too. My guess is that when watchOS 2.0 comes out, that we will see those sort of performance improvements.
I hope so.
I hope so too.
And the other complaint I have, and I've talked about it before, is the 17-second timeout, even in the stopwatch mode. When you're trying to clock something or you're giving a demo to a friend, having the face blot out at 17 seconds is a real pain. And considering that I'm getting about 70% battery remaining each night, I was 75% the other night, I think there's plenty of opportunity to give the user control over the timeout period. And there's sometimes when you're timing something like, you know, your boot up of a Mac or something else, you really need to have that display lit up for a minute or so. So this unmodifiable 17-second timeout has got to go.
Well, hopefully we will get the option to control that ourselves. That would be nice. So, hey, we have a sponsor this week. And our sponsor is lynda.com. And I'm pretty excited about that because I love the training that they offer. I've talked about it before, and I just can't help but talk about it again. I'm really enamored with the Photoshop training that they have. And I spend so much time in Photoshop. There's so much that I do with Photoshop. And I can still go to lynda.com and learn more. I just love that. And I love that there are other topics where you can already know so much. And if you go to lynda.com, you will learn more. I think that's just the coolest thing. So what they've done is they've set up all these training videos, and they're bringing in new videos all the time because there's new things for people to learn. They have over 3,000 titles right now, and they're broken up into segments so that they're easier to follow along and you're not going to get overwhelmed. And if you start following along one of the videos, say on your Mac, but then you have to stop and pick up again later on your iPad, your iPad will know where your Mac was in the video, so you don't have to scrub through to find your place. I just love that. It saves so much time. It's so convenient. And so many awesome, awesome training courses to choose from. I love that Lynda has decided that all of our listeners should get to try this out for free. So what you need to do is go to their website, lynda.com, that's lynda.com/TDO. And when you go to that specific URL, you're going to get the opportunity to sign up for a 10-day free trial. And during that 10 days, you have access to all the content that Lynda has available. So it's not like you can get teasers of videos or a subset where you can learn some esoteric topic that is going to be great for someone, but maybe not for you. No, it's everything that's there. So you can go and give it a spin and see if it really does work for you. And I'm betting it will, because if I can go and find stuff that's really useful for me, then I'm betting you guys can too. So head over to their website, lynda.com/TDO. Get yourself 10 days for free and start getting yourself smarter right away. Okay. The other thing that I wanted to take a look at before we have to wrap up, John, is a piece you wrote yesterday, which is something that I think is in the, well, I don't know if it's at the forefront of everyone's mind, but it's something that we're all right now, I think, more aware of, and this is security and software.
Right. The article was an interview, actually, with the CEO of Gala in Portland. And the article was How to Write Secure Software Guaranteed. You know, I had run across some frightening security scenarios in previous weeks with articles at Particle Debris, some internet snafus, Heartbleed, Logjam. And it got me thinking about how one writes secure software. So I open up the May issue of Aerospace and Defense, and there on page 40 is an article about this company in Portland, Gala, G-A-L-O-I-S, about how they're part of a team that's writing provably correct and provably secure software. That got my undivided attention. So I read the short article in the magazine, and I thought, I need to talk to these guys, find out how they're doing this. So I went through channels, and I got connected with their PR guy, and he set me up with an interview with Rob Wildbank, the CEO, who's a former professor, a PhD, and is now the CEO of Gala. And he tutored me on some of the issues. I had a lot of legacy questions about this kind of thing, and he kind of just laid it out in several steps. And basically, it's a three-step process. You use design tools. One of them is UML. One of them is AADL, Architecture Analysis and Design Language, where you design the language, where you design the code first. Independent of writing any code, you design the system, how it's going to work, what the inputs and outputs, and how you want it to function. And then you use another tool, this mathematical tool, which he didn't go into deeply, which looks at the different states that the software could be in and analyzes that mathematically. And then the third step is computer code generation. And part of that is picking the right language. And we talked for a little bit about how there are some languages that are more amenable to writing secure software. It turns out there are some languages, and we laughed about Perl, that has a pleasant built-in ambiguity that allows things to move along nicely. But when you're writing secure software, you want a language that's very strongly typed and doesn't allow you to express ambiguous ideas to the code. It forces you into being very explicit about what your intentions are. And he's talked about how their popular language is Haskell. And actually, Apple's Swift has some roots in Haskell, because you must express your intentions exactly to these languages. So once the code is designed, and then you let the code generate or generate code that is very carefully constructed, and then test it. And if it doesn't work right, you can't hand tweak it, because that just introduces problems. You have to go back and look at the design again, figure out what was wrong with either the code design or the code generator. And because the code generator is used so often and tweaked so highly, it's considered much more reliable than letting a human write code. So when you go through this three-step process, you've got code that is provably secure and provably correct, because it only does what it's supposed to do. And if the design is sound, then the code's not going to have any lapses or flaws or holes or uncertainties in the way it executes that you don't understand. So it was a very interesting interview.
Okay, so in essence, what they're doing is creating a system where humans work with computers as collaborators to create code, as opposed to humans just sitting down at a computer and writing code.
Right. We talked about how in modern technology, with companies like Apple and Google and Microsoft and Amazon, there's always commercial pressure. You're trying to get a product out the door, You're not willing to do team programming where you have two guys or two people, you know, a guy and a girl or whatever the mix is, working side by side, watching over each other's shoulder. That just doubles the cost of writing the code. So we have this cultural meme, you know, the brilliant programmer sits there and writes code himself, and he thinks he understands the code, or she does, but what happens is that he's still subject to human weaknesses and mistakes. And then there's time pressure. So you combine the fact that you don't have multiple people writing the code, you have pressures to get the code out, and you, that just ends up with flaws. So and he closed the interview by saying that until we start getting more mature in the way we write critical code, operating system code, and networking code, by designing sound systems and letting the code generators write sound code, we're going to continue to have these kinds of security snafus and problems that are just simply the result of time pressure and human failings and rushed code.
All right. Well, we're out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up. But, man, I'd really like to see some of this code in action.
Yeah, I'm going to stay in touch with these guys.
Yeah, good, because I'm betting that that there's some really cool stuff that's going to come out.
Yeah, they're working with autonomous systems. Just to wrap up real quickly, Rob mentioned that they are working with some very big companies on autonomous systems. And by autonomous, we mean by inference, self-driving cars, family robots, machine, cyber mechanical systems, he calls it, that where we depend on them, we trust them. And in order to trust the device, we have to trust the code, and we have to trust the intentions of the code developers. So they're doing some serious work, probably with automotive companies, on autonomous and provably secure and reliable code. That's good to know.
Awesome. All right. I'm looking forward to our new robot overlords. And John, thank you for being here today.
You're very welcome.
And lynda.com, thank you for being our sponsor this week. Head over to their website, please, lynda.com/TDO. Sign up for a 10-day free trial and start learning just gobs and gobs of really cool new things. And listeners, thank you for joining us yet again today. We'll see everyone tomorrow.